Aloha, everybody. This is Kathy Bilski, the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPR and radio. And this is August 14th, 2020. Well, tonight I thought I would do something I don't really do. And it's I am going to read to you Mary Trump's book. And if you don't know who Mary Trump is, she's the niece of Donald Trump, and she wrote a book called Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. So go get your wine if you haven't already, or your beer. Go smoke that doobie or get it lit and just relax tonight and enjoy story time. And we'll see how much of this we can get through. So we're just going to go ahead and get into it. All right, so this is a prologue. I'd always liked my name. As a kid at sailing camp in the 1970s, everybody called me Trump. It was a source of pride, not because the name was associated with power and real estate. Back then, my family was unknown outside of Brooklyn and Queens, but because something about the sound of it suited me, a tough six-year-old afraid of nothing. In the 1980s, when I was in college and my Uncle Donald had started branding all of his buildings in Manhattan, my feelings about my name became more complicated. 30 years later, on April 4th, 2017, I was in the quiet car of an Amtrak train headed to Washington, D.C. for a family dinner at the White House. 10 days earlier, I had received an email inviting me to a birthday celebration for my aunts, Marianne, turning 80, and Elizabeth, turning 75. Their younger brother, Donald, had occupied the Oval Office since January. After I emerged into Union Station with its vaulted ceilings and black and white marble floors, I passed a vendor who had set up an easel with buttons for sale. My name in a red circle with a red slash through it. Deport Trump, dump Trump, and Trump is a witch. I put on my sunglasses and picked up my pace. I took a cab to the Trump's International Hotel, which was compting my family for one night. After checking in, I walked through the atrium and looking up at the glass ceiling and the blue sky beyond, the three-tiered crystal chandeliers that hung from the central beams of interconnected girders arching overhead, casting a soft light. On one side, armchairs, settees, and couches, royal blue, robin's egg blue, ivory, were arranged in small groups. On the other, tables and chairs circled a large bar, which I was later scheduled to meet my brother. I had expected the hotel to be vulgar and gilded. It wasn't. My room was also tasteful, but my name was plastered everywhere and everything. Trump shampoo, Trump conditioner, Trump slippers, Trump shower cap, Trump shoe polish, Trump sewing kit, and Trump bathrobe. I opened the refrigerator, grabbed a split of Trump white wine, and poured it down my Trump throat so it could, of course, through my Trump bloodstream and hit the pleasure center of my Trump brain. An hour later, I met my brother, Frederick Chris Trump III, whom I've called Fritz since we were kids, and his wife, Lisa. Soon we were joined by the rest of the party, my Aunt Marianne, the eldest of Fred and Mary Trump's five children and respected federal appeals court judge, my Uncle Robert, the baby of the family, who for a short time had been one of Donald's employees in Atlantic City before leaving on bad terms in the early 1990s, and his girlfriend, my Aunt Elizabeth, the middle Trump child, and her husband Jim, my cousin David DeMone, Marianne's only child, and the oldest Trump grandchild, and his wife, and a few of my aunt's closest friends. The only Trump sibling who would be missing from the celebration was my father, Frederick Chris Trump Jr., the oldest son whom everybody had called Freddie. He had died more than 35 years before. When we were finally all together, we checked in with the White House security agents outside, then piled haphazardly into the two White House vans like a JV lacrosse team. Some of the older guests had trouble negotiating the steps. Nobody was comfortable squeezing onto the bench seats. I wondered why the White House hadn't thought to send at least one limo for my aunts. As we pulled into the South Lawn driveway 10 minutes later, two guards came out of the security hut to inspect the underside of the van before we drove through the front gate. After a short drive, we stopped at a small security building adjacent to the East Wing and disembarked. We went inside one by one as our names were called, handed over our phones and bags, and walked through a metal detector. Now, once inside the White House, we walked in twos and threes through the long corridors, past windows looking out on gardens and lawns, past life-size paintings of formal first ladies. I stopped in front of Hillary Clinton's portrait and stood silently for a minute. I wonder again how this could have happened. There was no reason for me ever to imagine that I'd visit the White House, certainly not under these circumstances. The whole thing felt surreal. I looked around. The White House was elegant, grand, and stately, and I was about to see my uncle, the man who lived here, for the first time in 8 years. We emerged from the shadows of the Hillary from the hallway onto the portico surrounding the Rose Garden and stopped outside the Oval Office. Through the French doors, I could see that a meeting was still in progress. Vice President Mike Pence stood off to the side, but Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, Senator Chuck Schumer, and a dozen other congresspeople and staffers were gathered around Donald, who sat behind the Resolute desk. The tableau reminded me one of my grandfather's tactics. He always made his supplicants come to him, either at his Brooklyn office or his house in Queens, and he remained seated while they stood. In late autumn 1985, a year after I had taken a leave of absence from Tufts University, I took my place in front of him and asked his permission to return to school. He looked up at me and said, "That's stupid. What do you want to do that for? Just go to trade school and become a receptionist." "Because I want to get my degree." I must have said it with a hint of annoyance, because my grandfather narrowed his eyes and looked at me for a second as if reevaluating me. The corner of his mouth lifted in a sneer and he laughed. "That's nasty," he said. A few minutes later, the meeting broke up. The Oval Office was born smaller and less intimate than I imagined. My cousin Eric and his wife Laura, who I'd never met, were standing right by the door. So I said, "Hi, Eric. It's your cousin Mary." "Of course I know who you are," he said. "Well, it's been a while," I said. "I think the last time we saw each other, you were still in school." He shrugged and said, "That's probably true." He and Laura walked away without his introducing us. I looked around. Melania, Ivanka, Jared, and Donnie had arrived and were sitting next to Donald, who remained seated. Mike Pence continued to lurk on the other side of the room with a half-dead smile on his face, like the chaperone everyone wanted to avoid. I stared at him, hoping to make eye contact, but he never looked away my way. "Excuse me, everyone," the White House photographer, a petite young woman in a dark pantsuit, announced with an upbeat voice. "Let's get you all together so I can take some pictures before we go upstairs." She instructed us to surround Donald, who had not gotten up from the desk. The photographer raised her camera. 1, 2, 3, smile," she said. After the pictures had been taken, Donald stood up and pointed to a framed black and white photograph of my grandfather, which is propped up on a desk behind, on the table behind the desk. Marianne, isn't that a great picture of Dad? It was the same photograph that had sat on the side table in the library of my grandparents' house. In it, my grandfather was still a young man with receding dark hair, a mustache, and a look of command that I've never seen falter until his dementia set in. We'd all seen it thousands of times. Maybe you should have a picture of Mom too, Marianne suggested. That's a great idea, Donald said, as though it had never occurred to him. Somebody get me a picture of Mom. We spent a few more minutes in the Oval Office taking turns, sitting beside the resolute desk. My brother took a picture of me, and when I looked at it, I noticed my grandfather hovering behind me like a ghost. The White House historian joined us just outside the Oval Office, and we proceeded to the executive residence on the second floor for a tour to be followed by dinner. Once upstairs, we proceeded to the Lincoln bedroom. I took a quick look inside and was surprised to see a half-eaten apple on the bedside table. As this historian told us stories about what happened in that room through the years, Donald pointed vaguely once in a while and declared, "This place has never looked better since George Washington lived here." The historian was too polite to point out that the house hadn't been open until after Washington had died. The group moved down the hall toward the treaty room and the executive dining room. Donald stood in the doorway greeting people as they entered. I was one of the last to arrive. I hadn't yet said hello, and when he saw me, he pointed at me with a surprised look in his face and said, "I specifically asked for you to be here." That was the kind of thing he often said to charm people, and he had a knack for tailoring his comment to the occasion, which was all the more impressive because I knew it wasn't true. He opened his arms, and then for the first time in my life, he hugged me. The first thing I noticed about the executive dining room was its beauty. The dark wood polished to perfection, the exquisite place settings, and the hand-drawn calligraphy on the place cards and menu. Iceberg lettuce, salad, mashed potatoes, Trump's family staples, and Wagyu beef fillet. The second thing I noticed after sitting down was the seating arrangement. In my family, you could always gauge your worth by where you were seated, but I didn't mind. All of the people I felt comfortable with, my brother and sister-in-law, Marianne's stepdaughter, and her husband, were seated near me. Each of the waiters carried a bottle of red wine and a bottle of white. Real wine, not Trump wine. That was unexpected. In my entire life, there had never been any alcohol at a family function. Only Coke and apple juice had been served at my grandparents' house. Halfway through the meal, Jared walked into the dining room. "Oh, look," Ivanka said, clapping her hands. "Jared's back from his trip to the Middle East," as if we hadn't just seen him in the Oval Office. He walked over to his wife, gave her a quick kiss on the cheek, then bent over Donald, who was seated next to Ivanka. They spoke quietly for a couple minutes and then Jared left. He didn't acknowledge anybody else, not even my aunts. As he crossed the threshold, Donnie leapt out of his chair and bounded after him like an excited puppy. As dessert was being served, Robert stood up, wine glass in hand. "It is such an honor to be here with the President of the United States," he said. "Thank you, Mr. President, for allowing us to be here to celebrate our sister's birthday." I thought back to the time the family had celebrated Father's Day at Peter Luger's steakhouse in Brooklyn. Then, as now, Donald and Rob had been sitting next to each other with me directly across from them without any explanation. Donald had turned to Rob and said, "Look." He bared his teeth and pointed at his mouth. "What?" Rob had asked. Donald had simply pulled his lips farther back and pointed more emphatically. Rob has started to look nervous. I had no idea what was going on, but watched with amusement while I sipped my coke. "Look," Donald had said through his gritted teeth. "What do you think?" "What do you mean?" Rob's embarrassment was palpable. He had glanced around him to make sure nobody was looking at him and whispered, "Is there something in my teeth?" The bowls of cream spinach scattered around the table rendered that a distinct possibility. Donald had relaxed his mouth and stopped pointing. The contemptuous look on his face summed up the entire history of their relationship. "I got my teeth whitened." "What do you think?" he had asked dryly. After Rob's remarks, Donald shot him that same dismissive look I'd seen at Peter Luger's for almost 20 years before. Then, Diet Coke, glass in hand, Donald made some perfunctory remarks about my aunt's birthday, after which he gestured toward his daughter-in-law. "Laura there," he said. "I barely even know who the fuck she was, honestly. But then she gave a great speech during the campaign and Georgia supporting me." By then, Laura and Eric had been together for almost 8 years. So presumably Donald had at least met her at their wedding, but it sounded as he hadn't known who she was until she had said something nice about him at a campaign rally during the election. As usual with Donald, the story mattered more than the truth, which was easily sacrificed, especially if a lie made the story sound better. When Marianne's turn came, she said, "I want to thank you for making the trip to celebrate our birthdays. We've come a long way since that night when Freddie dumped a bowl of mashed potatoes on Donald's head because he was being such a brat." Everyone familiar with the legendary mashed potato story laughed. Everyone except Donald. He listened with his arms tightly crossed and a scowl on his face, as he did whenever Marianne mentioned it. It upset him as if he were that 7-year-old boy. He clearly still felt the sting of that long ago humiliation. Unprompted, my cousin Donnie, who'd returned from chasing down Jared, stood up to speak. Instead of toasting our aunts, he gave a sort of campaign speech. Last November, the American people saw something special and voted for a president who they knew understood them. They saw what a great family this is, and they connected with our values. I glanced at my brother and rolled my eyes. I flagged down one of the waiters. "Can I have some more wine?" I asked. He returned quickly with two bottles and asked if I preferred red or white. "Yes, please," I said. As soon as we finished dessert, everyone rose. Only 2 hours had elapsed since we entered the Oval Office, but the meal was over and it was time to leave. From beginning to end, we have spent about twice as much time at the White House as we ever had at my grandparents' house for Thanksgiving or Christmas, but still less time with Donald than Kid Rock, Sarah Palin, and Ted Nugent would 2 weeks later. Somebody suggested that we all take individual pictures with Donald, though not without with the guests of honor. When it was my turn, Donald smiled for the camera and gave me a thumbs up, but I could see the exhaustion behind the smile. It seemed that keeping up that cheerful facade was wearing on him. "Don't let them get you down," I said to him as my brother took the picture. It wasn't long after his first national security advisor had been fired in disgrace, and the cracks in his presidency were already beginning to show. Donald jutted out his chin, clenched his teeth, and looking for a moment like the ghost of my grandfather. "They're not going to get me," he said. When Donald announced his run for the presidency on June 16th, 2015, I didn't want to take it seriously. I didn't think Donald took it seriously. He simply wanted the free publicity for his brand. He'd done that sort of thing before when his poll numbers started to rise and he may have received tactic assurances from Russian President Vladimir Putin that Russia would do everything it could to swing the election in his favor. The appeal of winning grew. "He's a clown," my Aunt Marianne said during one of our regular lunches at the time. "This will never happen." I agreed. We talked about his reputation as a faded reality star and failed businessmen would doom this man. Does anybody even believe the bullshit that he's a self-made man? What has he even accomplished of his own, I asked. "Well," Marianne said, as dry as the Sahara, "he's had 5 bankruptcies." When Donald started addressing the opiate crisis and using my father's history with alcoholism to burnish his anti-addiction bona fide to seem more sympathetic, both of us were angry. "He's using your father's memory for political purposes," Marianne said, "and that's a sin, especially since Freddie should have been the star of the family." We thought the blatant racism on display during Donald's announcement speech would be a real deal breaker, but we were disabused of that idea when Jerry Falwell Jr., the other white evangelical, started endorsing him. Marianne, a devout Catholic since her conversion 5 decades earlier, was incensed. "What the fuck is wrong with them?" she said. "The only time Donald went to church was when the cameras were there. It's mind-boggling. He has no principles, none." Nothing Donald said during the campaign, from his disparagement of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, arguably the most qualified presidential candidate in the history of the country, as a nasty woman, his mocking of Sergei Kovalevsky, a disabled New York Times reporter, deviated from my expectation of him. In fact, I was reminded of every family meal I'd ever attended during which Donald would talk about all the women he considered ugly fat slobs, or the men, usually more accomplished or powerful, he called losers, while my grandfather and Marianne Elizabeth and Robert all laughed and joined in. That kind of casual dehumanization of people was commonplace at the Trump dinner table. What did surprise me was that he kept getting away with it. Then he received the nomination. The things I had thought would disqualify him seemed only to strengthen his appeal to his base. I still wasn't concerned. I was confident he would never get elected. But the idea that he had a shot at it was unnerving. Late in the summer of 2016, I considered speaking out about the ways I knew Donald to be completely unqualified. By this time, he had emerged relatively unscathed from the Republican National Convention and his call for Second Amendment people to stop Hillary Clinton, even his attack on Karzai Ghazala Khan, Gold Star parents whose son, whom I own, a U.S. Army captain, had died in Iraq, seemed not to matter. When the majority of Republicans polled still supported him after the excess Hollywood tape was released, I knew I had made the right decision. I began to feel as though I was watching my family history and Donald's central role in it playing out on a grand scale. Donald's competition in the race was being held to higher standards, just as my father had always been, while he continued to get away with it and even be rewarded for it. Increasingly crass, irresponsible, and despicable behavior. "Oh, this can't be happening again," I thought, but it was. The media failed to notice that not one member of Donald's family, apart from his children, his son-in-law, his current wife, said a word in support of him during the entire campaign. Marianne told me she was lucky because as a federal judge, she needed to maintain her objectivity. She may have been the only person in the country, given her position as a sister and her professional reputation, who, if she had spoken out about Donald's complete unfitness for the office, might have made a difference. But she had her own secrets to keep, and I wasn't entirely surprised when she told me after the election that she voted for her brother out of family loyalty. Growing up in the Trump's family, particularly as Freddie's child, presented certain challenges. In some way, I've been extremely fortunate. I attended excellent private schools and had the security of first-rate medical insurance for most of my life. There was also, though, a built-in sense of scarcity that applied to all of us, except Donald. After my grandfather died in 1999, I learned that my father's line had been erased from the will as if Fred Trump's olden son had never existed, and a lawsuit followed. In the end, I concluded that if I spoke publicly about my uncle, I would be painted as disgruntled, disinherited niece looking to cash in or settle a score. In order to understand what brought Donald and all of us to the point, we need to start with my grandfather and his own need for recognition, a need that propelled him to encourage Donald's record, reckless hyperbole, and unearned confidence that hid Donald's pathological weakness and insecurities. As Donald grew up, he was forced to become his own cheerleader, first because he needed his father to believe he was a better and more confident son than Freddie was, then because Fred required it of him, and finally because he began to believe his own hype, even as he paradoxically suspected on a very deep level that nobody else did. By the time of the election, Donald met any challenges to his sense of superiority with anger, his fear and vulnerabilities so effectively buried that he didn't even have to acknowledge they existed, and he never would. In the 1970s, after my grandfather had already been preferring and promoting Donald for years, the New York media picked up the baton and began disseminating Donald's unsubstantiated hype. In the 1980s, the banks joined in, and when they began to fund his ventures, their willingness, and then their need, to foster his increasingly unfounded claims to success hung on the hopes of recouping their losses. After a decade during which Donald floundered, dragged down by bankruptcies, and reduced to fronting for a series of failed products, from steaks to vodka, the television producer, Mark Burnett, gave him yet another chance. The Apprentice traded on Donald's image as a brash, self-made dealmaker, a myth that had been the creation of my grandfather 5 decades earlier, and that astonishingly, considering the vast trove of evidence disproving it, had survived into new millennium, almost entirely unaltered. By the time Donald announced his run for the Republican Party nomination in 2015, a significant percentage of the American population had been primed to believe that myth. To this day, the lies and misrepresentations and fabrications that are the sum total of who my uncle is are perpetuated by the Republican Party and white evangelical Christians, people who know better, such as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, true believers, such as Representative Kevin McCarthy, Secretary of State Mike Papano, and Attorney General William Barr, and others too numerous to name, have become, unwittingly or not, complicit in their perpetuation. None of the Trump siblings emerge unscathed from my grandfather's sociopathy and my grandmother's illnesses, both physical and psychological. My uncle Donald and my father Freddie suffered more than the rest. In order to get a complete picture of Donald, his psychopathologies, and the meaning of his dysfunctional behavior, we need a thorough family history. In the last 3 years, I've watched as countless pundits, armchair psychologists, and journalists have kept missing the mark, using phrases such as malignant narcissism and narcissistic personality disorder in an attempt to make sense of Donald's often bizarre and self-defeating behavior. I have no problem calling Donald a narcissist. He meets all the 9 criteria outlined in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But the label gets us only so far. I received my PhD in clinical psychology from the Derner Institute of Advanced Psychological Studies. And while doing research for my dissertation, I spent a year working on the admissions ward of Manhattan Psychiatric Center, a state facility where we diagnosed, evaluated, and treated some of the sickest, most vulnerable patients, in addition to teaching graduate psychology, including courses in trauma, psychopathology, and development psychology for several years. As an adjunct professor, I provided therapy and physical psychological testing for patients at a community clinic specializing in addictions. Those experiences showed me time and again that diagnosis doesn't exist in a vacuum. Does Donald have other symptoms we aren't aware of? Are there other disorders that might have much or more explanatory power? Maybe. A case could be made that he also meets criteria for antisocial personality disorder, which in its most severe form is generally considered psychopathy, but can also refer to chronic criminality, arrogance, and disregard for the rights of others. Is there comorbidity? Probably. Donald may also meet some of the criteria for dependent personality disorder, the hallmarks of which include an inability to make decisions or take responsibility, discomfort with being alone or going to excessive lengths to obtain support from others. Are there other factors that should be considered? Absolutely. He may have a long undiagnosed learning disability that for decades has interfered with his ability to process information. Also, he is alleged to drink upward of 12 Diet Cokes a day and sleep very little. Does he suffer from a substance, in this case caffeine, induced sleep disorder? He has a horrible diet, does not exercise, which may contribute or exacerbate his other possible disorders. Fact is, Donald's pathologies are so complex and his behavior so often inexplicable that coming up with an accurate or comprehensive diagnosis would require a full battery of psychological and neuropsychological tests that he'll never sit for. At this point, we can't evaluate his day-to-day functioning because he is, in the West Wing, essentially institutionalized. Donald has been institutionalized for most of his adult life, so there is no way to know how he would thrive or even survive on his own in the real world. At the end of my aunt's birthday party in 2017, as we lined up for our pictures, I could see that Donald was already under a kind of stress he'd never experienced before. As the pressures upon him have continued to mount over the course of the last 3 years, the disparity between level of competence required for running a country and his incompetence has widened, revealing his disillusions more starkly than ever before. Many, but by no means all of us, have been shielded until now from the worst effects of his pathologies by a stable economy. That's going, isn't it, guys? And a lack of serious crisis. Whoa. Now remember, this book was written before all this stuff happened. But the out-of-control COVID-19 pandemic, the possibility of an economic depression, deepening social divides among political lines, thanks to Donald's penchant for division and devastating uncertainty about our country's future, have created a perfect storm of catastrophes that no one is less equipped than my uncle to manage. Doing so would require courage, strength of character, deference to experts, and the confidence to take responsibility and to course correct after admitting mistakes. His ability to control unfavorable situations by lying, spinning, and obfuscating has diminished to the point of impotence in the midst of the tragedies we now are facing. His egregious and arguably intentional mishandling of the current catastrophe has led to a level of pushback and scrutiny that he's never experienced before, increasing his belligerence and need for petty revenge as he withholds vital funding, personal protective equipment, and ventilators that your tax dollars have paid for from states whose governors don't kiss his ass sufficiently. In the 1994 film based on Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's novel, Frankenstein Monster says, "I do know that for the sympathy of one living being, I would make peace with all. I have love in me the likes of which you can scarcely imagine, and rage the likes of which you would not believe. If I cannot satisfy the one, I will indulge the other." After referencing that quote, Charles P. Pierce wrote in Esquire, "Donald doesn't plague himself with doubt about what he's creating around him. He is proud of his monster. He glories in its anger and its destruction. And while he cannot imagine its love, he believes with all his heart in its rage. He is Frankenstein without conscience." That could have more accurately been said about Donald's father, Fred, with his cruel indifference. Fred's monster, the only child of his who mattered to him, would ultimately be rendered unlovable by the very nature of Fred's preference to him. In the end, there would be no love for Donald at all, just his agonizing thirst for it. The rage left to grow would come to overshadow everything else. When Rona Graff, Donald's longtime gatekeeper, sent me and my daughter an invitation to attend Donald's election night party in New York City, I declined. I wouldn't be able to contain my euphoria when Clinton's victory was announced, and I didn't want to be rude. At 5 o'clock the next morning, only a couple hours after the opposite result had been announced, I was wandering around my house as traumatized as many other people, but in a more personal way. It felt as though 62,979,636 voters had chosen to turn this country into a macro version of my malignantly dysfunctional family. Within a month of the election, I found myself compulsively watching the news and checking my Twitter feed, anxious and unable to concentrate on anything else. Though nothing Donald did surprise me, the speed and volume which he started inflicting his worst impulses on the country, from lying about the crowd size at the inauguration, from whining about how poorly he was treated, rolling back environmental protections, targeting the Affordable Care Act in order to take affordable health care away from millions of people, and enabling his racist Muslim ban. That overwhelmed me. The smallest thing, seeing Donald's face or hearing my own name, both of which happen dozens of times a day, took me back to the times when my father had withered and died beneath the cruelty and contempt of my grandfather. I had lost him when he was only 42 and I was 16. The horror of Donald's cruelty was being magnified by the fact that his acts were now official U.S. policy affecting millions of people. The atmosphere of division my grandfather created in the Trump family is the water in which Donald has always swum, and division continues to benefit at the expense of everybody else. It's wearing the country down, just as it did my father, changing us even as it leaves Donald unaltered. It's weakening our ability to be kind or believe in forgiveness, concepts that have never been had any meaning for him. His administration and his party have become subsumed by his politics of grievance and entitlement. Worse, Donald, who understands nothing about history, constitutional principles, geopolitics, diplomacy, or anything else, really, was never pressed to demonstrate such knowledge, has evaluated all of his country alliances and all of our social programs solely through the prism of money, just as his father taught him to do. The costs and benefits of governing are considered in purely financial terms, as if the U.S. Treasury were his personal piggy bank. To him, every dollar going out was his loss, while every dollar saved was his gain. In the midst of the obscene plenty, one person using all of the levers of power and taking every advantage at his disposal could benefit himself and conditionally his immediate family, his cronies, and his psychopaths. For the rest, there would never be enough to go around, which is exactly how my grandfather ran our family. It's extraordinary that for all of the attention and coverage that Donald has received in the last 50 years, he's been subjected to very little scrutiny. Though his character flaws and aberrant behavior have been remarked upon and joked about, there's been little effort to understand not only why he became who he is, but how he's consistently failed up despite his glaring lack of fitness. Donald has, in some ways, always been institutionalized, shielded from his limitations or his need to succeed on his own in the world. Honest work has never been demanded of him. And no matter how badly he failed, he was rewarded in ways that are almost unfathomable. He continues to be protected from his own disasters in the White House, where a clack of loyalists applauds his every pronouncement, or covers up his possible criminal negligence by normalizing to the point that we become almost numb to the accumulating transgressions. By now, the stakes are far higher than they've ever been. They are literally life and death. Unlike any previous time in his life, Donald's failings cannot be hidden or ignored because they threaten us all. Although my aunts and uncles will think otherwise, I'm not writing this book to cash in or out of a desire for revenge. If either of those had been my intention, I would have written a book about our family years ago, when there's no way to anticipate Donald would trade on his reputation as a serially bankrupt businessman and irrelevant reality show host to ascend to the White House, when it would have been safer because my uncle wasn't in a position to threaten and endanger whistleblowers and critics. The events of the last 3 years, however, have been forced my hand, and I can no longer remain silent. By the time this book is published, hundreds of thousands of American lives will have been sacrificed on the altar of Donald's hubris and willful ignorance. And if he is afforded a second term, it would be the end of American democracy. No one knows how Donald came to be who he is better than his own family. Unfortunately, almost all of them remain silent out of loyalty or fear. I'm not hindered by either of those. In addition to the firsthand accounts I can give as my father's daughter and my uncle's only niece, I have the perspective of a trained clinical psychologist. Too much and never enough is the story of the most visible and powerful family in the world, and I am the only Trump who is willing to tell it. I hope this book will end the practice of referring to Donald's strategies or agendas as if he operates according to any organizing principles. He doesn't. Donald's ego has been and is a fragile, inadequate barrier between him and the real world, which, thanks to his father's money and power, he never had to negotiate by himself. Donald has always needed to perpetuate the fiction that my grandfather started, that he is a strong and smart and otherwise extraordinary, because facing the truth that he is none of those things is too terrifying for him to contemplate. Donald, following the lead of my grandfather, with the complicity, silence, and inaction of his siblings, destroyed my father. I can't let him destroy my country. All right, now we are in part one. Cruelty is the point. You have to admit, this is pretty good stuff, right? I mean, if you haven't bought the book, I bought it because I wanted to support his niece. And it's good stuff. All right, here we go. Chapter one, the house. Daddy, Mom's bleeding. They lived in the house as my grandparents' home was known for less than a year, and it still felt unfamiliar, especially in the middle of the night. So when 12-year-old Marianne found her mother lying unconscious in one of the upstairs bathrooms, not the master bathroom, but the bathroom she and her sister shared down the hall, she was already disoriented. There was blood all over the bathroom. Marianne's terror was so great that it overcame her usual reluctance to disturb her father in his bedroom, and she flew to the other end of the house to rouse him. Fred got out of bed, walked quickly down the hall, and found his wife unresponsive. With Marianne at his heels, he rushed back to the bedroom where there was a telephone extension and placed a call. Already a powerful man with connections at Jamaica Hospital, Fred was immediately put in touch with someone who could get an ambulance to the house and make sure the best doctors were waiting for them when they arrived at the emergency room. Fred explained the situation as best he could to the person on the other end. Marianne heard him say, "Menstruation," an unfamiliar word that sounded strange coming out of her father's mouth. Shortly after Mary arrived at the hospital, she underwent an emergency hysterectomy after doctors found that serious postpartum complications had gone undiagnosed after Robert's birth 9 months earlier. The procedure led to an abdominal infection, and then further complication rose. From what would become his usually spot by the telephone table in the library, Fred spoke briefly with one of Mary's doctors, and after hanging up the phone, called Marianne to join him. "They told me your mother won't make it through the night," he said to his daughter. A little while later, as he was leaving for the hospital to be with his wife, he told her, "Go to school tomorrow. I'll call you if there's any change." She understood the implication. "I will call you if your mother dies." Marianne spent the night crying alone in a room while her younger siblings remained asleep in their beds, unaware of the calamity. She went to school the next day full of dread. Dr. James Dixon, the headmaster of Kew Forest, a private school she had become attending when her father joined the board of directors, came to get her from study hall. "There's a phone call for you in your office." Marianne was convinced that her mother was dead. The walk to the principal's office was like a walk to the scaffold. All the 12-year-old could think of was that she was going to be acting mother of four children. When she picked up the phone, her father simply said, "She's going to make it." Mary would undergo two more surgeries over the next week, but she did indeed make it. Fred's pull at the hospital, which ensured that his wife got the very best doctors and care, had probably saved her life, but it would be a long road back to recovery. For the next 6 months, Mary was in and out of the hospital. The long-term implication for her health was serious. She eventually developed severe osteoporosis from the sudden loss of estrogen that went with having her ovaries removed along with her uterus, a common but often unnecessary medical procedure performed at the time. As a result, she was often in excruciating pain from spontaneous fractures to her ever-thinning bones. If we were lucky, we have as infants and toddlers at least one emotionally available parent who consistently fulfills our needs and responds to our desires for attention, being held and comforted, having our feelings acknowledged, and our upset soothed are all critical for the healthy development of young children. This kind of attention creates a sense of safety and security that ultimately allows us to explore the world around us without excessive fear or unimaginable anxiety, because we know we can count on the bedrock support for at least one caregiver. Mirroring the process through which an attuned parent reflects, processes, and then gives back to the baby, the baby's own feelings, is another crucial part of a child's development. Without mirroring, children are denied crucial information both about how their minds work and about how to understand the world. Just as a secure attachment to a primary caregiver can lead to a higher levels of emotional intelligence, mirroring is the root of empathy. Mary and Fred were problematic parents from the very beginning. My grandmother rarely spoke to me about her own parents or childhood, so I can only speculate that she was the youngest of 10 children, 21 years younger than her oldest siblings and 4 years younger than the second oldest. As she grew up in an often inhospitable environment in the early 1910s, whether her own needs were sufficiently met when she was young or for some other reason, she was a kind of mother who used her children to comfort herself rather than comforting them. She attended to them when it was conveniently for her, not when they needed her to. Often unstable and needy, prone to self-pity and flights of martyrdom, she frequently put herself first, especially when it came to her sons. She acted as if there were nothing she could do for them. During and after her surgeries, Mary's absence, both literally and emotional, created a void in the lives of her children. As hard as it must have been for Marianne, Freddie, and Elizabeth, they were old enough to understand what was happening and could, to some extent, take care of themselves. The impact was especially dire for Donald and Robert, who at 2.5 years and 9 months old, respectively, were the most vulnerable of her children, especially since there was no one else to fill the void. The live-in housekeeper was undoubtedly overwhelmed by the sheer volume of housework. Their paternal grandmother, who lived nearby, prepared meals, but she was as terse and physically unaffectionate as her son. When Marianne wasn't in school, much of her responsibility was taking care of the younger kids. Fell to her. As a boy, Freddie wouldn't have been expected to help. She gave them baths, got them ready for bed, but at 12, there was only so much she could do. The five kids were essentially motherless. Whereas Mary was needy, Fred seemed to have no emotional needs at all. In fact, he was a high-functioning sociopath. Although uncommon, sociopathy is not rare, afflicting as much as 3% of the population. 75% of those diagnosed are men. Symptoms of sociopath is not rare, afflicting as much as 3% of the population. Again, symptoms of sociopath include our lack of empathy, a facility for lying, an indifference to right and wrong, abusive behavior, and lack of trust in the rights of others. Having a sociopath is apparent, especially if there is no one else around to mitigate the effects, all but guarantees severe disruption on how children understand themselves, regulate their emotions, engage with the world. My grandmother was ill-equipped to deal with the problems caused by her marriage, by Fred's callousness, indifferent, and controlling behaviors. Fred's lack of real human feelings, his rigidity as a parent and a husband, his sexist belief in a woman's innate inferiority likely left her feeling unsupported. You think? Since Mary was emotionally and physically absent due to her injuries, Fred became by default the only available parent, but it would be a mistake to refer to him as caregiver. He firmly believed that dealing with young children was not his job and kept to his 12-hour-a-day, 6-day-a-week job at Trump's management, as if his children could look after themselves. He focused on what was important to him, his increasing successful business, which at the time was developing Shorehaven and Beach Haven, two massive residential projects in Brooklyn that were to date the most significant of his life. Again, Donald and Robert in particular would have been in the most precarious positions vis-a-vis Fred's lack of interest. All behavior exhibited by infants and toddlers is a form of attachment behavior which seeks a positive, comforting response from the caregiver. A smile to elicit a smile, tears to prompt a hug. Even under normal circumstances,